to live coverage of the 1986 Ice Noodling for Muskies World Championships, brought to you live from Minocqua, Wisconsin.
Hey guys, the Ice Noodling for Muskies 1986 World Championships is proudly brought to you by these fine sponsors: Ham's Beer, Glass Beer, Old Style Beer, Mad Dog Party Punch, Auto Cigarettes, Top 45 Home Liquor, and last but definitely not least, Shred.
All right there, folks, this is your host, Dick Stimke, with my co-host, Fritz Chatterworth. Fritz, how are you doing this frigid morning here for the 1986 Muskie Ice Noodling World Championships? Fritz, are you fired up?
Dick, I'm beyond fired up. I mean, I'm with the great Dick Stimke.
Thank you.
This is Fritz Chatterworth coming to you also, and I am happy as a lark.
Look, I'm looking to see who's got the biggest ice hole to get that muskie through it. What do you think there, Fritz?
It's hard to say at this point. I mean, the competition's just begun, but boy, oh boy, is it exciting.
Now, according to international rules that apply on this tournament, your ice hole can only be 10 inches. Fritz, how big is your hole?
It's a lot bigger than that, Dick.
I tell you what. Anyway, I'm looking forward to a just steady competition. Who's going to get down there? Who's going to noodle up these muskies? Who's man enough to win the 86 World Championship? Who's your money on there, Fritz?
Tune in right now, because being careful has nothing to do with it.
Absolutely
when you're reaching for
not
a vicious, flesh-ripping muskalunch. We got
lunch.
Rookies and we got seasoned veterans.
Absolutely. I've got some money right now. I know I'm hosting the show, so it'd be bad for me to gamble on it, but it is the 80s, and I'm a fan of Pete Rose, so I've got $1,100 on Gunter Shylock to run away with this thing.
He's good. He's proved himself before, but the great Fred Sykovich is also on my radar.
Now, Fritz, if anybody here today that knows what it takes to be a champion is Fritz Chatterworth, the 1982, 1983, now there's an asterisk in 83 for cocaine use, and 1984 Ice Muskie World Champion, Fritz Chatterworth. Fritz, what's it going to take today to put muskies through your hole?
Well, what's it going to take? I tell you what, this ain't no catfish we're dealing about here, you know. They tend to really punish the competitors who go
Absolutely.
In there blind. You've got to know what you're doing, Dick.
You know what? Talk about the training. Talk about the mental preparedness to stick your hand in that hole, wiggle those fingers until a muskalunge just goes, wah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've lost a few digits. I mean, I'm proud to say that I put my dues in. You know what
and
I'm saying?
And he's proud
I mean,
to be an American.
Yeah. You're going to get hurt. You're going to bleed.
Folks, that's fantastic. We need to take a quick commercial break from one of our fine sponsors.
What are we doing?
We're
fire brewing. Well, let's get hot.
Stroh's Beer. Brewed for flavor over fire. Fire brewed at 2,000 degrees. You get more flavor because fire brewing brings out all the flavor of the finest ingredients in Stroh's beer.
All right, folks, we're back live at the 1986 Ice Noodling for Muskie World Championships here in live in Minocqua, Wisconsin. Fritz, I'm fired up. I am so fired up. We're starting to hear some early results. These guys are starting to pull some things out of their own ice holes.
Dick, this is America in a nutshell. I mean, think about it. You got all the great minds and all the great people together in one amazing event on the ice.
Absolutely.
You got Ed Kukulinski.
Yes.
You got Carl Hildebrand.
Come on.
Right?
Come on.
Come on. You got Mike Knutson.
Absolutely.
Come
Russ
on.
Russ Smith is here.
He is. He's a newcomer.
Absolutely.
The Barney Toffel of Vizism. Am I pronouncing that right?
It doesn't matter. He's a hero. An American ice hero.
What about Gunter? Gunter Shylock. The guy's solid.
Fritz, I'm starting to hear some feedback. Hold on. I got my earpiece in, Fritz. Are you there? Fritz.
Dick.
You know it's here. All right. I'm getting word. Ed Kukulinski just jerked a 39-incher out of his ice hole. What do you think? Is it going to be enough to put him on the big board, put him in the money? And by money, he wins a 24-pack if he takes this thing home. But nonetheless, those things are getting more expensive every day. You know what I'm saying, listening at home. What do you think, Fritz? Is this going to be enough to put Ed Kukulinski on the big board?
he's on the map. I mean, okay, bottom line, he's on the map. He could go all the way with this thing. The EMTs have been running around. Everybody's busy. We've got refreshments. We've got food. We got the bratwurst. I mean, we got everything. We got
hold on. Breaking news. Breaking news here, Fritz. Breaking news. I'm just coming in. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Game-changing news here. Judges just found Gunter Shylock has been rubbing his hands on suckers before he noodled for muskies. Completely illegal. He's eliminated from the tournament.
Not permitted.
You can't do it.
Bye now.
Yeah, nope. That's it. That you cannot rub live bait on your hands before you noodle for these things. Completely in international competition, completely illegal. Now I'm at $1,100 to my bookie, but nonetheless.
Dick, we heard about the Dr. Juice incident.
That was just a short decade ago. There was Dr. Juice. Everybody was juicing, they called it.
They were juiced. They were jacked.
They were jacked on the juice.
It's just not fair.
Not fair. This is flesh and bone in fish
face. Keep it fair. Bleed for America. I say bleed for America.
Absolutely.
For the love of Pete.
Watering gardens is my line, says Green Thumb Jay McGrew. But when you want to quench your thirst, then here's the thing to do. You ought to make friends with Valley Forge, the beer with a wonderful flavor. Make friends with Valley Forge. Do yourself a big favor.
It's pale. It's light. It's smooth.
It always tastes just right. So you ought to make friends with Valley Forge, the beer with a wonderful flavor.
All right, folks, welcome back from that commercial break. Fritz, I'm telling you, I'm getting word here in the earpiece. Mike Knutson and Ed Kukulinski, it sounds like they pounded a couple big ones out of their own holes. It sounds like their holes are on fire. They're really pulling away from the pack. Fritz, you know better than anybody what it feels like when your hole's on fire. Tell the people watching at home, what's it like when you got a hot hole?
When my hole is on fire, it's an absolutely great feeling, Dick. I mean, it's just absolutely the best in the world. When I took home the cup a few years ago back in 84 World Championships, what you're doing is standing on the shoulders of giants on the ice.
Giants on the ice. All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 Podcast. Jay Bird.
Steve, how
are
you doing?
What are you thinking? Man, I am so sick of the radio in Minocqua. Straight up weird, dude.
There's some weird stuff out there, but, you know, it's good to hear from the old noodling championship back then, you know, a little recap.
Well, that's before they outlawed it.
I see.
You know, I think the only remnant still in the muskie industry from the noodling era, as we call it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is Dr. Juice.
Dr. Juice survived.
The rest of them, you know, you see a Smitty, ask a Smitty about it. Be like, you know, hey, I heard tale of back in the 80s. Yeah.
Yeah. Russ's first tournament he ever fished or noodled.
Down there two-handed, face down on the ice, finger shaking, both hands.
Yeah. He brought the crackers.
What was crazy is he invented, and it was short-lived after he joined the league, he did double jazz hands. Caught a lot of fish with it, you know, just both hands through the hole, right? Face down on the ice. Sometimes he used a pillow or a t-shirt and just both hands down there, just waving his fingers till a muskie ate it. You know, he called it double jazz hands. It was banned after a while. It was just too effective. So, you know,
it's a technique that stood the test of time, really.
He also implemented early versions of what he called man optics, where he stuck his head under the ice. And just look for them.
Sure.
There's one 40 feet out. You know, but you have that. Anyway, speaking of Smitty's, Jay, just got in. I landed on a jet plane.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, went up. I had a business meeting, if you will. Ran into the Smitty's. They were doing the Milwaukee musky stuff that they do every year. Saw a Smitty in the wild.
I've been there. I know what you're saying.
Wild Smitty. I'm going. We're at a steakhouse. I walk by him. I go, are you kidding me? I hadn't slept in 30 hours, by the way, which is just how it happens when you're traveling a bunch out there doing deals, folks, doing deals. But, I was sitting there with Herbeck, and I went, oh, my God, it's a Smitty. So, Wild Smitty
If you look at the thumbnail on the app this week, it's of me and a wild Smitty I caught.
I gotcha.
Folks, it's like a Pokemon. Pokemon, if you will. Jay, have you ever caught a Pokemon?
No.
Jay, how many Pokeballs do you have?
I don't.
That is weak.
Yeah, I know.
We are the musky podcast of the millennials. They love the Pokemans.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right? Japanese stuff. Jay, how kawaii are you?
Cool. I have no idea.
Jeez. Why are you even on the show?
I don't know. Tell me about dinner with Smitty's.
What's wrong with you? Jesus. What is wrong with you? Get with it. The kids are into this Pokemans and whatnots.
Yeah, and I'm just not that hip.
It pertains to musky fishing, the Pokemans.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
Folks, I'm here to announce the new Livingston Lures Pikachu. I ran into a Smitty. He was eating a steak. It was amazing. Now, here was freaky, right? Walked by him. We're at the old Texas Roadhouse. Steve Paul Staple, right? If you want to have a Stephen Paul sighting, guess what you do? You go to a Texas Roadhouse, right?
Right, they don't miss.
They don't miss. I'm going to have a blue rare sirloin, 14-ounce baked potato Caesar salad. That's how I roll, right? And I mean blue. I mean, I want you to smack this thing on the ass, throw him on the grill. He's barely dead, right? I want to see blood. So I walk by. Here's Smitty. This guy just has a slab of meat, no sides. So utter respect. not a vegetable in sight, not a roll. He just says, send me half a cow. So
I thought you were going to say they ordered a half chicken or something like that. You know.
Well, I was talking to his parental unit.
At a steakhouse.
No. We had that discussion.
Okay.
His better half said, no chicken here. So he asked for it. He was like, do you guys have boiled chicken? No, you're having a steak. Man up.
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Man up. And he manned up. I love Jake anyway. So we will wrestle at the Muskie Shop Bash July 15th, right? We talked about it. It's not going to be staged. The hate between me and Jake Smith is real. Absolutely real. Feverish pitch, Jay. Feverish pitch. Right? We squared up there in the Texas Roadhouse. So if you want to see me wrestle Jake Smith, July 15th, Muskie Shop Bash. Randy Howe, Bassmaster Classic winner, going to be there. Joe Booker's going to be there. Steve Herbeck, right? Me and Jake Smith squaring off for the Muskie Tag Team Championship. Are you ready for that, Jay?
I'm trying to prepare myself.
Can you
Sounds
even take
awesome.
It?
I don't know where we're going to do that. We're going to have to get, do we have to build a cage for that? Or, I mean, what do you do?
Now, me and Jake, once we got done screaming at each other, right, over who was the best, he said he was going to build a cage out of Smitty jerkbaits.
Okay. So, with the hooks off.
Or on.
Oh.
So it's
throw the element of danger back right
well,
in
we
the mix.
We got a tracer tail cage match is what we call it.
Tracer tail cage match.
Yeah. Right? So you get thrown against the wall, you're going to get hooked. You never know, folks.
Well, that bash is going to be...
You better be there.
A list of excitement.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It might happen. It might not. You know? How do you know if you're not there?
The threat is real.
There could be a tracer tail cage match going down right there in the parking lot. July 15th, Monaco, Wisconsin. I'm calling you out, Jake Smith. I hope you're ready. Anyway, goodness. People are definitely, after they listen to that intro, Jay, of us flipping channels, ready for us to get into musky fishing. They're praying that we'll do it. They go, for the love of God, I thought this was a musky podcast, not your...
The intro was about muskies. I mean, it was long. It was worth every penny.
Jay, shut up. Stop. Kevin asks, what are your four top trolling baits, Jay? And what are your four top trolling baits, Steve? based upon where you guys fish. I know Jay fishes in rivers in Wisconsin and some lakes, from what I'm hearing you guys talk about, and Steve does both in Canada. What are your four go-to trolling baits? Why, when, where, please? Jay.
Sure.
Let them rip.
Number one, and it's a new one.
If you say Smitty bait, you're on my list.
the hate list. No. Slammer. The new Slammer 6-inch fatty minnow.
Can I talk about slamming? I'm going to slam Jake Smith July 15th, Minuski Spusky Shop Bash. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Into
yeah.
the seriousness. Top four yeah. trollers.
Yep. Right there. Number one. Number two. I'm going a little bit deeper.
I didn't like catch what you said.
1800.
Hold on,
Slammer 6-inch fanny minnow, that one that came out, you know, the prototypes that we got mm-hmm. last summer, we did well with.
Is that like and shallow trolling for you as far as like
that's,
over top
that's shallow trolling. Okay.
Yep, like that yep, two yep. to shallow. Four kind of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to troll a little bit deeper than that, probably troll in the 5-6 range, but mm-hmm. yep, that's a great one and high vibration, and it's going to run great slow. Same thing with the, you know, Suic 1800 Cisco Kid, love mm-hmm. those. Headlocks and matlocks. You can run them shallow as you want.
That is true.
And you're going to say that, have that on your list, obviously. Yep. Number four, you know, I don't do a lot of trolling, but that would be my game plan. Those would be my top three. I'll give you my top three right there. I'll think about it. Why don't you give me your top four?
I know your fourth, which is like rip trolling Titans and Sandcats.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Because you'll get in the I'm not trying to speak for you.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Because you'll get in the again, Jay, and I'm just not trying to speak for you, but you've told me before where you'll do like if you're running like the Wisco River or something like that, where you're doing those holes and you'll rip. Because like the Sandcat's so shallow, it's almost like ripping a minnow bait or like the Titan with no weights in those pockets. I mean, I know you do that.
Yep. You're absolutely right. Yep, that's something you can control. You know, with our one line per in Wisconsin, it's like that's something that you can do while you're running the tiller. I mean, I got a little tiller boat, so problem solved right there. That's a good technique for getting shallow. We did that a little bit with Titans last year, actually, yep. too, you know, when those started coming out. So,
bang, bang.
Yep.
Four for me.
Like you said, you know, you don't have to think 100% crankbaits when it comes to trolling. It didn't even cross my mind there. I was just thinking
I wasn't trying
my top
to speak
four
for
crankbaits.
Yeah, but
I know. It's perfect. It's true.
Well, you know, is one. You always think crankbaits. But if I'm going, Kevin, I'm going my top four trolling baits. Not crankbaits, baits. Headlocks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I love them. I'm a headlock nut. If you haven't noticed, Duff's doing a custom Steve Paul collar for a reason. Muskie Shop's got it. You know, there's a reason.
Yeah, that,
I'm a nut. I love them. Bigger the better. If I'm going to troll, I don't want a 32. You know, I'm not interested in a 30-inch fish trolling. I'm just simply not. You know, gas is expensive, Jay.
There you go.
So headlocks. I'll lump headlocks and matlocks. Let's just call it supernatural baits. Those are my number one. Those are my babies. Love them. Let's rock and roll, right? The where, when, and why, we ain't got time for that. So, number two, straight Joe Bucher Outdoors Depth Rater. Sucker pattern.
Yep. Okay.
If you gave me two trolling baits, you said, Steve, you can pick two trolling baits. I'm taking a 10-inch Steve's Musky Thunder headlock and a freaking straight DR sucker. I can catch them from here to Canada. Forget about it, right? Now you go, why would you pick those two? I'm going to run the headlock in good conditions, right? Moderately decent conditions. The Steve's Musky Thunder, which is pretty much black with some flash. I'm going to run that on my shallower end of things. When muskies have moved into littoral zones or shallow edges or whatever. And when things really suck, I'm going to put out 8 billion feet of line. Like I've talked about this before. I mean, whatever, boat controller. When things are nasty, I want to take that sucker depth ring and I want to break the lip on it. That is my goal, is to tick and click until something breaks with an 8-inch DR. That would be 1 and 2. Number 3. Number 3.
Livingston.
No, Viper. I'm going to say.
Joining crankbait.
No, not the pounder.
Yeah,
I want to give up some. You know this. I did it enough for the last 2 years. So Livingston has this bait called a Viper, right?
Yeah.
It is a big glide bait. It's one of these jointed glide baits where you reel the bait and it goes left to right. I have so much fun with that bait. I will just launch a cast and throw that in the prop wash, and it's walking the dog behind the bait like 3 feet under the surface. I love that. I think that's so much fun because you just go, okay, I'm just walking the dog over this thing. What are my favorite? You're not asking what are my most productive. What are my favorite?
Yeah, I love
that. We're going to skip the obligatory Titan. I'll rip Troll Titans, whatever. Moving on. You know, who cares what I say about that? Oh, number four would be a bulldog with blades in front of it.
Dozer attachment going.
And I will take a standard bulldog with blades in front of it, and I'll put weight in front of that to get it down deep. So here's this funky way pain in the butt thing to run. I love it. It's like one of those things. Sometimes the harder it is, the more rewarding it is. So a standard bulldog with double eight Dozer blades with 2 ounces of lead in front of it. I feel very like I've done something. You know what I'm saying, Jay? Like, look what I did.
Sure. Okay.
Those are my favorite. Not my most productive, but my favorite. Those are my favorite. I would say if I took it to most productive, headlocks, Titans in the prop wash, and ace baits on really long lines. Like ace baits and outside weed edges, ace baits or rad dogs or figure eights, all very productive. I'm not saying it's an ace. I'm just saying like that style, the big musky spinner bait on a long line are probably my most productive. If it's great conditions, it's not post frontal or it's not high skies, I'm going to run a Colorado. If it's post frontal and it's kind of gnarly, I'm running a Willis or run a bit deeper. Those would be my go-to there. 5 seconds on the thing that we both cover because I don't know. And again, I love Jay. Jay's my best friend. I love you, Jay. Hello. Hello.
Dick Stimpke
here in the house. I was just about to bust you because I will rip troll the Titan where you rip troll the Sand Cat, right?
Sure.
And I'll punch you in the face if you ever do it. No, I love the Sand Cat because I don't think the Sand Cat is in the same world as a Titan as far as diving rides. It's more of this like forced dive and rise minnow bait presentation, right? So
yeah,
if you're fishing,
that's the way I see it too. Yeah,
I hate to say that, and Tom LeBeau, great bait builder. If you guys ask me who does the best paint jobs in the musky business, who am I gonna say, Jay? Tom LeBeau.
Big Tom, absolutely.
Who has the most consistent baits in the musky industry? Tom LeBeau. Who doesn't put out baits that have faults in them? Tom LeBeau. I mean, I'll own it. That guy is flawless in everything that he does. The most meticulous, painstaking, beautiful everything. And it's like one of these things of like, you're a bait maker. If you're sitting in your garage and you build baits, and this is a whole other tangent, right? I'm sorry. If you're going to judge your work, right? And in all endeavors, we sort of gauge our things, right? We all want to be Joe Bucher as musky fisherman on the water. Or we all want to be Slash if we're guitar players or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. If you are a basement bait builder, the guy you need to look at that does it by himself from cutting the wood to pouring the lead, to aligning the hook hangers, to painting the bait, to doing the clear coat, to doing the finish work, the whole bit, from a piece of wood to a bait that runs perfectly. Tom LeBeau is absolutely the benchmark in the muskie industry. Hands down. Flawless. Right? So, yep. if and I get messages from people all the time. Hey, I built this. Hey, I built that. What do you think? Right? I'm very honest in my reply to them. Right? Another guy, Lawrence Bendy out of Canada, right? He does he sent us some awesome dive and rise baits and some they're almost like this reef hoggy subsurface thing. His work was flawless, right? You know, Tom and him, some guys where you go, those are the benchmark you need to look at. If you're building a bait and you're going, does it work? And I'll admit this, and I would say it to Tom. Tom's a great guy. You know, when I did the Titan, I was doing the original prototypes of the wooden Titan. I wanted that level of accuracy. And I think it's so awesome. And I'm not endorsed by Tom. It's not that. I just have the utmost respect for him because his stuff is spot freaking on. Right? Doesn't miss. I've had... oh, goodness, Jay. Over the years now, 50, I use a lot of the avatars, right? Which is, for you guys that are shad basers, right? We're on a tangent here. Bear with me. A lot of you high Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania shad base guys, right? You're going, well, I buy this, that, or the other, these plastic, quote-unquote, shad baits, or I buy these custom shad baits that are made by Johnny so-and-so, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've just become a guy that uses the avatar because the consistency is there where I go, these are wooden baits. However, there's such a low level of variation between them because he's hand selecting the wood. His finish is spot on. He doesn't really have a variance in how thick the finish is, the lip angle, or any of this stuff where I go, okay, I tear through some balsa wood avatars in a week, I get two more and I'm right back dialed in. I'm not compensating because the variation in the bait itself. So anyway, Tom, I'm sorry. I love you. So, please, Tom. But, you know, and as an aside, if you're one of these guys that's making baits, you're prototyping a bait, that is what you should aspire to. You buy five sand cats and you throw five sand cats and you go, huh, they're all the same. Those are wooden baits. That's called attention to detail.
Right? That's what it is, for sure.
You know, attention to the finish, attention to alignment. At some point, and Jay will attest, if you talk to Tom, and we have, and Jay has, and all this stuff, very much maybe too involved when you talk to him, right? You're like, whoa, I'm checking out, right? He's saying a lot, but it doesn't register. It's that attention to detail, that's that OCD that I find amazing there. Anyway, back to what I was getting at, sorry, is that Jay on the Wisconsin River or whatever section of the river you're fishing there, a lot of really shallow sections, right? A lot of stuff that's varying. So you might need to compensate really quickly due to line length or rod angle. So you can bang into the rocks. You can sort of make that contact that's going to get you those trolling strikes. You know, and that's what's going to kind of cool about that bait, because you're going to have a way different sort of dive curve at 15 feet of line versus 30 feet of line, you know, and you're going to see it and you can sort of get that minnow bait shimmy that worked with that current you're dealing with. So, you know, you're getting a fat minnow, almost a slammer, a crane bait action on the wobble, right? This machine gunning effect that's really putting off a lot of vibration. So that would be my take there. I'm sorry I went off on the Tom LeBeau tangent. I always think, every time I think about him, G, do you know what I think about? Tom Baudet. So, Motel 6, we'll leave the light on for you.
Yeah, that's right.
Josh, What do you recommend for spooky or line shy, leader shy, or simply boat shy muskies in clear water? What do I recommend? Well, let's think about this for a second. We've been talking baits, right? The knee-jerk reaction to a question like that would be, what baits do I recommend? Where my brain went. Probably everybody else's did. What I recommend is better casts and better boat control. Okay? So, Josh, I'm not sure if casting's an issue. Probably not. However, the only time I'm really focused on bomb casts is when I'm noticing that muskies sort of get boat shy or they get funky because maybe the boat's casting a shadow. Maybe they're seeing my shadow. Maybe it's just so gin clear that they're seeing a litany sure. of things.
Yeah.
What I'm going to do is once I've figured out that they are there, I'm going to attempt to get further off the brake line edge, structural edge, cover edge, whatever we're targeting. Adding distance is going to help you, right? Secondly, adding what I call mid-cast triggers is going to help you immensely because let's say, for example, and I've brought it up before in the past, Jay, I went out to the West Coast. I did that tiger muskie trip a few times where I've gone to Washington, Oregon, and fished for tigers out there, right?
Yeah, right.
These totally. Are literally trout waters. When I say trout waters, I mean these are salmon and kokanee and rainbow trout waters, salmonoid species, right?
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
are clear as a bell. And guess what? Tigers don't like figure eights, right? They're not real into this whole figure eighting ordeal, just like a northern. It's hard to keep a northern engaged. Tigers sort of have that northern pike thing where once you know where they're at, you need to come back and you need to back her way off and you need to focus on what I'm going to do about at the 3/4 point or the midpoint of my cast that's going to elicit sure. this strike. Right?
Yep.
So let's say, for example, and I'm just going to throw this one out here. Let's say, and at the same token, let's say a hellhound and a bulldog, right? Similar in size, so like a 7-inch and the standard 8-inch. If I'm throwing that, I'm getting action on those. I'm not going to try to bring them in the figure eight. When I'm 20 feet off the boat, I'm going to go ahead and start my dead stick. I'm going to let that thing sink to the bottom and rip it up. So I'm taking that fish deep so he's not seeing the boat or he's not getting out into open water, seeing the shadow, whatever it is that keeps these fish from wanting to engage in a figure eight, right? If I'm fishing crankbaits, I'm going to make sure that when I'm getting to that 3/4 point or midpoint, you know, I'm assuming I've engaged the fish. I can't see them. I'm going to do a big float up and then a big rip down and a big float up and a big rip down on slack line. So I'm not advancing so much, but I'm adding some action. You know, same thing with a Titan. You know, I'm working it deep. And then, you know, once I'm at that midpoint, I'll let it float up and another big rip and another big rip and another big rip before I sort of come into that last quarter, last half of my retrieve for a figure eight. If I'm positive that I'm on bodies of water where muskies are spooky, maybe it's tiger muskies, those stalkers out west, whatever it might be, where instead of counting on my boat side maneuvers to close the deal, I need to add that 3/4 or midpoint part of my cast where I'm counting on that to close the deal.
Sure.
So if you eliminate the possibility of a figure eight catch, it becomes incumbent on you as an angler to pick a point in your retrieve where you go, this is my changeup, right? Now, when I'm dealing with spooky muskies, genuinely spooky muskies, I'm not talking like they're coming in, you can't keep them engaged. I'm talking like you see them 20 feet out and they just break off to the left or the right and they're out of there, right?
Yeah.
It's a rarity, but it happens. that midpoint trigger is going to be more focused with, I'm going to be looking at what sinking baits do I have to take that thing deep, right? Or what rising baits, like a Titan or a Bulldog, right? So a Bulldog's going to sink, a Titan's going to rise, that I can sort of manipulate on some slack line that's really not advancing back to the boat very much. Okay? Beaver bait, Suic, sand cat, whatever it might be. How much play, how much action can I get out of this bait where I can rip it a little bit and it'll back up, or I can jerk it and it'll back up, or I can jerk it and it'll fall, right? Where I'm not always advancing it back towards myself. The other trick is this. If you're confident, let's say you're fishing gin clear water, you can see them coming from a mile away, and you just keep getting follows and nothing will happen. This is something I've done on Eagle Lake, which is notoriously clear. I've done actually on those tiger muskies on that water that is like, Jay, you could take a glass, throw it in the lake and drink it. It's clear as a bell, right? You see them coming and you get to that point where, man, they've been breaking off here. Now, that's a number you'll have to figure out after like a few mess ups, right? I will hammer the trolling motor and turn it into trolling. I've caught them that way. Notorious with the pounder and the baby, or the jointed DR, right? I see them coming. They haven't eaten yet. I've tried some mid-retrieve jerk stuff. I've tried to let it float up. He's still there. I'll just hit the trolling motor and just keep him off the side of the boat and just drag it for a minute, right? Now, this is not something I do every time. This is not something I recommend to do the first time you have a follow, but you get 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 tiger musky follows or clear water musky follows and you're banging your head against the wall, right? Move that fish, have your trolling motor set on high, and you see him coming and you go, he's going to break off. This is where they keep breaking off. Just jam the trolling motor out into open water and hold the rod. Take him out to open water. Just like you would walk a sucker fish that won't eat on panoptics out to deep water, right? Drag that fish out into open water on the trolling motor where he's not seeing you. Right? Now, what I'm talking about here is this. The trolling motor and take him out to deep water, it's not about the boat. We're not turning this into a trolling pass so much as the lure cannot catch up with the boat if the boat is advancing, Jay. Rip it. Let it float up. Surge forward. Don't reel. Right? That keeps him away from the boat. You can jerk bait with a Titan. You can jerk bait with a floating crank like a jointed DR or a Livingston Pounder. Right? Or keep a Bulldog going. If you don't reel, rip. Surge the boat forward till the slack comes up. Rip. Now, he's not getting close to the boat. Again, what I would say is this. It is rare, in my opinion, that muskies are boat shy. It does happen. There are some bodies of water that are so clear that they sort of go, that's not normal. Why am I coming up here? 100% with those tiger muskies. I don't know if they're more visual or not. They do not like getting near the boat. So if you engage with that fish and you go, man, I've had enough follows. I know they're not going to come up any closer and I can't get them going. Take the slack of your line with the trolling motor. Now, we've retained the same distance with the trolling motors taking the slack out. Rip trolling motor out. Rip trolling motor out. We can just keep this thing going and speed it up, slow it down as we need to be. That is a last case option. Sam just bought a new Beast reel from the Muskie Shop. Thank you, Sam.
Awesome, Sam. Thanks.
What kind of backing do I need for muskie fishing, and what line do the podcast guys recommend? Jay, we were talking about line today. What do you know?
We were talking about line. When it comes to backing, just monofilament, 20-pound mono works great. It grips the reel just fine, so just tie a knot, secure it on there.
Here's the thing, though. In all reality, I mean, it doesn't have to be 20. It could be 10. I mean, if you get down to the backing, you're in trouble. 20's pretty safe. I've used 30. I think that, Jay, explain real quickly, and like I said, let's just say it's 20 or whatever. The point of the backing is not for tensile strength, though. right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're filling up the empty portion that you'll never use.
And
so,
it's to give the braid a grip.
Right. It's got a grip to the spool, yeah. If you don't have good backing on there, if it's not attached to the spool properly and mono grips great, it'll appear that your drag isn't functioning right, you know, mm-hmm. and the line will just rotate around the spool. So it's a very, very common problem when people spool their own line at home, and sometimes they forget or they just don't do it right. So it happens a lot. So
one thing,
yeah, it's pretty easy to do. And, you know, you'll learn trial and error how much backing to put on, but, you know, most musky size reels, general guideline is go about a third of the way up with mm-hmm. backing and then put your main line over that.
Mm-hmm. Number one, that saves you some money.
Yeah.
You're never going to see that line on a cast unless something goes diabolically yeah, wrong. Right. You're never going to see that on a fish. Tips on backing real quick, right? Jay, and admittedly, are you ready for something embarrassing? Let me pull this down. What do we got? My father bought this. Oh, my goodness. I can't even imagine. Made by Maxima Manufacturing Company,
mm-hmm.
Malign, Germany. East Germany. Oh, my God. I never saw that. I have this bulk spool, right, of line that was considered to be 30-pound monofilament.
Okay.
It's in my hand right now. This is before the Berlin Wall came down, folks.
Oof.
This spool of line is a family heirloom to such an extent it's ridiculous, right? It is probably, God, how long is it going to be when the Berlin Wall come down? That's embarrassingly funny.
89, I think.
Okay, so this line is pre-1989. I've been using this same spool since I was a child to back musky reels. When we were doing a Boo Garcia 6501s and 6500s, we've been using the same spool of backing line this entire time, the entire family.
Cool.
And this thing is older than original sin, and it doesn't matter. And it is, honest to goodness, probably going to last another generation of my family before we run out of it. But all I'm looking for with that line, I'm not looking for strength. That is, dude, I seriously didn't even look at that. That's funnier than hell. This spool line. All I do when I come, I'm gonna line up a reel, right? I run the line through the face of the reel. I come in, I make whatever knot I make on the reel. Jay, I'm sure there's some amazing knot that you're supposed to use when you're putting it on the reel, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One thing I'll say is this, folks. If you don't know a good knot, tie a lot, right? If you don't know a good knot, tie a lot. But whatever knot it is I tie, I think I tie like double overhands to my spool. What I'm going to immediately do, so this backing line, this monofilament I've tied to the spool, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take a piece of electrical tape and I'm going to run it over top of that monofilament knot so it touches the spool, right, and brings that knot down. That electrical tape gives the mono something to grip, right? It keeps the mono from moving unless you have some of those spools, Jay, have a hole through the middle, right? Not many.
Some right, it's rare, but some do.
Some I think 13s do. The 13 fishing reels have a hole in the middle. So if you got a hole through your spool, yeah, run your line through that, tie through that hole. But if you just are tying a knot to the spool, run a piece of electrical tape over it, like on an Abu or a Tranks or whatever. One layer of electrical tape, and then put monofilament over top it, one third up, and then tie you whatever kind of knot. What do you guys do? Blood knots.
Yeah, I'd use a blood knot. Yep.
To me, you could do, and I'll just tell you this much. If you get down to the backing, you're so in a pickle anyway, it doesn't matter. What I usually do to connect my main line and my braid, or my, excuse me, backing line, my braid line to a double overhand or something, You know, I don't. At that point, when we're down to backing, I'm not considering that it's even gonna. I'm gonna lose the fish if we get that far down. I'm sure a blood knot's far better. But whatever knot you choose to use on that, that braid's gonna dig in. Now, if you know you're not going to be throwing these bomb casts or you're gonna change line regularly, you could theoretically, what I do on client reels on my boat, Jay, is half spool, right? With mono and then a half spool of braid. Saves you a ton of braid. Right? And so half the spool is monofilament backing and then half the spool is braided line. And once you start getting low on that, you just pull that off and you're continually just putting a half spool of braided line on. So it saves you a quarter of a spool of line that's never going to see the water.
Yeah, I mean, depending on the line you're going to use, you're mm-hmm. probably, you know, getting 100 yards on there, and that's more than enough to get through a season.
Dude, think about it. You're end zone to end zone on a football field with a muskie. Are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm. Not going to happen.
Not going to happen. Come on. Give me a break. You know, we don't need 500 yards of line on a muskie rod or reel. So,
nope.
You know, that will save you a little bit of line. You get a little bit more life out of a spool or a bulk spool or whatever it means. That monofilament, all it is creating frictional force for that braid to dig into. You should have no slippage, right? The rule of thumb for me putting that backing on, once I put the electrical tape on, I've tied my knot, I put a layer on that. I want to give it a pretty firm tug to make sure it's I'm not saying it's pull and drag. I just want to make sure it's dug into itself. Then I put my braid on. As far as brand of braid, you know, made a change here recently, Jay. And yeah. I have been definitely playing with that J braid and the Berkeley stuff. I can't remember the Berkeley stuff off the top of my head. I talked to Jim earlier.
Is that X9?
Week. He sent me, you know, we did some stuff. He definitely hooked me up with J braid, right? Yeah. We were fishing J braid in Wisconsin. I was like really into it. And Jim's a big J braid guy, right?
Yeah.
So that and the Berkeley X9, good stuff.
Yeah. I use Cortland Master Braid. I love that mm-hmm. stuff.
And, you know, there's not a bad brand, but I hate to say this. Seems like the bigger the brand, the more problems they have, right? The more you make, the more error you have. And I'll leave it at that for right now, you know. But, you know, definitely if you're looking for a line, and the thing is, this line's such a weird deal where if you're not confident in your line, you're not confident in your entire setup, I really feel like that J braid's going to be a place where you can start at. If you don't have a line where you go, this is my line, I think the price point on J braid and the quality of the J braid's a really good place where you go, okay, I'm a J braid dude, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's some of this stuff that's on the market. We don't even sell some of this stuff. I won't say it by name. That is like total Chinesium. That is like so-and-so braid or whatever braid or this braid or that braid. We go, man, I'm not confident in the consistency. Right? Spool to spool, day to day. That would be the thing. So J-braid's pretty good. But anyway, that's our masterclass on line backing. So Jay,
yep, there you have it.
What color line backing do you use? Do you think it matters what color backing you have on your reel?
Backing? Not at all. No.
I think it matters a ton.
In what way?
I think muskies know if you got blue backing or clear backing or green backing on your rod.
Okay.
I know they know. They can smell it. Anyway, Steve, just listen to your jigging masterclass. Wasn't a masterclass. Close, but it wasn't. Tried our best. We just sort of riffed that one. Must take issue with your tactic of kissing the bottom with your body. As I approach retirement after 22 years of service in the same firm, I can assure you that kissing the bottom hasn't worked out worth anything for me. Indiana Dave. Dave from Indiana.
Dave.
Give him a big podcast salute, Jay.
Hello.
22 years of service at the same firm. Dave, you haven't been kissing hard enough. Make hard bottom contact at work just like you do with your Bondi babe, right? Hard bottom contact is going to get you more strikes. Kiss that bottom harder. Matt is up here and he says, what is the best use for a 7.6 medium heavy Mojo musky rod? Best news. Okay.
Okay. Well, seven, anglers that are smaller in stature, number one, they're going to benefit from that.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly beginners, but I don't recommend going that short unless, you know, it's going to fit your boat stance a little bit better, you know, in terms of how you stand. And maybe, you know, some people fish out of bass boats. You're super low to the water and you want to work jerk baits, or you want to work certain baits where you're, you know, you got the downward angle on the rod consistently and mm-hmm. something like that. A 9-foot rod's going to get in the way. It'll be a little bit more cumbersome. So, to each his own. You know, you find out what works best for you by getting out there and making it happen.
I'm here in the bait cave, right?
Okay.
And the roof of my garage, folks, if you saw it, it is a pile of rods. Jay, you know this as well as anybody. I have enough rods that I try to give them away every year when I come up to Wisconsin. Hey, do you need a tube full of rods? Can I unload these on you? Can I get rid of these? I don't want to throw them away. A lot of them are antiquated and old. You know, I went through when 7.6 was the rage, I had a ton of them. 8.6, 8-foot, you name it. Been there, done
it. Yeah, me too. Right.
You know, me and Jay are both taller in stature. Neither of us are going to sort of rely on a 7.6 as far as our go-to rod. So if it's a stature thing, if you're 5'5 to 5'8, maybe it's the right rod, whatever. But if I have a 7.6, and the one thing I'll say is this, there's one rod that I take to Canada every year that is a 6'9" St. Croix Premier, right? What? Are you kidding me?
For your jackpots?
For my post giant jackpots.
I knew it.
Reef hogs and jackpots. Mm. Were made based upon 6'6", 6-foot, maybe 7'6" rods.
Snap, snap, snap.
Snap, snap, snap. If you are on a topwater bite, Eagle Lake in Ontario is made for post giant jackpots. Always will be, always has been. Reef hogs as well. Right on Wabagoon, where I fish as well. Over on the Goon, Tom Foodally made a freaking name for himself fishing reef hogs over there, right? Short rods. So if you're on a dialed in topwater bite on walk the dog side to side, let that semi walk the dog, that semi glide reef hog, or that post giant jackpot, man, is it easier on those short rods. Mm-hmm. The reason being, and I can work any of those on my big shield rods, right? 9-foot, 9.6 is easy. Right? I'm kicking the rod off to my side to do that, right? If I'm dialed in on that bite, I like that shorter rod because it's the rod's right in front of me. It's a more direct snap to the bait. And so my old school setup, and I take it every year up north with me. Jay, we actually have laughed about it. We actually did a Todd and Dave with one of the reels. It is a 6501 Abu Garcia on a 6'9" St. Croix Premier.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, this year, what I actually have done, I already got it rigged up, is I'm going to do one of my 5.3-1 Abus on a 8-foot musky rod, right? Because I'm taller and it's about the same thing. 7.6, if you're doing a topwater thing, man, it might be the perfect thing. So that would be my application outside of just trolling it. Steve says, hey guys, I keep running into this issue with my MEPS double-bladed marabou bucktails and was hoping your Jedi wisdom and guidance would help me. After a few casts, the blades will get stuck together and foul the bait a bit with one blade tucked directly behind the other. I'd like to keep throwing them because the chicks dig it, but I want to be more efficient. Greatly appreciate your help so much. I love MEPS blades, right? I think the thinness of their Marabou and their Flashaboo blades are pretty good. They start way faster, right? Which gives you a little bit more depth control. I've not had a problem with them sort of sticking together where you start one and the other one comes in behind it, right? However, I've had that with other bucktails over the years. Here's the trick that I've found that will keep that from happening. So it's kind of goofy. Bear with me. What I will do is if I have blades that like to find one another and create and I don't know if this is the appropriate name, Jeff, happened between the backs of two blades, right?
Yeah.
That is because you have two very flat surfaces. If I have a bucktail that's driving me nuts, I will take a Brillo pad. I will scrub the inside of the blades, the cup side, right? With a little piece of steel wool, like a Brillo pad or a steel wool, whatever. Scratch, 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 scratch. And it solves the problem. Because now it's not a flat surface area. It's got cracks and fissures and scratches in it where it can't allow those two flat surfaces to kind of meet and conjoin. Right? It's a rarity, but it happens. One thing I do is this, is make sure your clevises are good. Make sure there's no issue. There's no bend in your clevises. But if you're continually getting stuck blades that find one another, that's an old school trick, man. Take a piece.
It's a good point about the clevis, Steve, because some of these bucktails, like MEPS, they use very fine diameter ones, very small. And that's part of the you know, allure of how great that thing runs and spins right away. So,
but
you keep it hooked, they will collapse.
Right, and all you're doing is you think about it like you take two sheets, and this is a bait maker thing, playing with thing. Take two sheets of Lexan, two flat surfaces, and put them together underwater. They'll find some kind of like adhesion, like some suction or whatever.
Yeah, true. Yeah, but I can see that.
Right, if you rough up that surface on the back of the first blade, like the blade that, if you take the clevises, wet blade is in front, right? Scruff it up, scruff it up, scruff it up, scruff it up. Now there's gouges, you know, see small, you can't see them with your eyes barely, gouges where they can't sort of make that suction together. That'll keep your blades going and keep that from happening. And like I said, the first thing that comes to mind for me, though, is those clevises. Check those out. Make sure they're in tune. If not, man, scrub the back of that first blade. Jason. Love the podcast. Really enjoy it. I hear a lot of talk about fishing shallow, mid, or deep water, no matter the species of fish, but I rarely hear of specific depths. My question is, when you talk about fishing shallow, mid, or deep, is there a specific depth range or ranges? Yes. So, for our purposes, let's talk structure fishing. Let's go to the structure fishing podcast we've done, or talk about the overarching methodology that I apply to everything I do in the muskie business, everything I do when we're doing the podcast, whether I'm writing, whatever it is, right? Quickly, I will cover it. The deep holes, pockets, main channel, main basin is the main home of a muskie throughout the majority of the year, right? Deep is a relative term, right? Some bodies of water, their maximum depth may be 15 feet.
Right, right.
Okay. Or the body of water I fish all the time, the maximum depth is 55 feet. There's another body of water I fish with some regularity that literally has an average depth of 190 feet at the bottom, right? Now, muskies are not going to really habitate zones past 40 feet with any regularity. So, in my brain, deep is 20 to 40, and that's deep, deep, right? Mid-depth would be 20 to 12, and then 12 to 0 is shallow. That's my average range. When you ask me what's shallow, mid, and deep, right? Mm-hmm. Littoral zone, and if you hear the term on this thing, I love saying littoral. Big word, $5 word. What that means is the area of a body of water, whether it's a river, a lake, a reservoir, doesn't matter. From 0 to 12 feet in general, with general water clarity, is how far that the sun can penetrate with light to kickstart vegetative growth. Okay? Sometimes in very clear bodies of water, that's deeper. Sometimes in darker, tannic bodies of water, it's shallower. But the littoral zone in general.
That's a good way to classify it. Right? I like that.
Could be notated as 0 to 12 feet. So shallow in my brain is my boat setting in 12, I'm casting to 0. Mid-depth as I'm fishing, really I'm targeting that 8 to 15, and truly deep is 15 and out. That would be if you wanted the Steve Paul primer of what we're looking at. If muskies are deeper than 25 feet, I'm going home and I'm going to take a nap after I eat a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now there's some places, and I, you know, we're covering so many areas and so many questions and so many zones and so many habits. I get it. St. Lawrence River, those are deep fish, man. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Some of these bodies of water in Canada, they're shallow critters. Some of the Midwest are super shallow. There's lakes in the Midwest where there's deep. But in general, now maybe this is a pressure thing, and I mean as far as like actual pressure on the swim bladder, whatever we want to come up with. I don't have the answer for it, but it is very difficult to target muskies past 25 feet. Right? Jay, you've heard it over the years. You even get on some of these bodies of water where these things are swelling like a toad with their swim bladder, and you got to bleed them out when you're targeting past that. Right?
Mm.
You know, these guys, have you heard that where they'll take a pin and stick it in them and like bleed them out?
Yeah, I've heard that.
I'm not into that.
No.
So once we're past 25 feet, I'm sort of checking out. I'm going, man, I got better stuff to do. It's hard enough. It can be done. Don't get me wrong. But in my wheelhouse, that's sort of the breakdown. 0 to 12. 12 to 15 to 18, maybe. 18 to 25. Those are my zones. Now, is it based on structure and average structure? What I'm basing it on is some of that. However, past that, we have very limited tools. So a topwater runs 0 feet, right? A bulldog competently runs 20 feet if you really want to do it and count it down. But most of our baits are tailor-made for those shallow water zones because muskies in general, when they're going to eat something, they move into quote-unquote shallow water. Now, if they're dormant, their home zones, where they choose to spend the majority of their time, is quote-unquote deep water, that movement might be from, say, a body of water that maxes out at 30 feet. They might only move up to 12 in the winter, or they might move up to 15, or they might move to 8, right? Shallow is a relative term based upon what's happening with conditions, what's happening with weather, what's happening with bait fish movements. Some of you guys are creakers, man. There might be 35 muskies in one deep hole, and they move up in the quote-unquote shallows to feed, and they go back in that hole, and they sit there. They don't bother each other. They don't care that they're there. They're there to shut their brains down and be dormant and conserve calories, right? So deep's a relative term. Shallow's a relative term. I've seen bodies of water. I've been fortunate enough to fish all over the habitat range. I've seen bodies of water where, man, they go from shoreline to 5 really quick and then down to 15. It's like, whoa, whoa, there's not a lot of this flat, you know what I'm saying, Jay? Like this,
yeah,
this right. Meandering Midwestern weed bed edges and stuff like that. So you got to take mid depth and shallow with a grain of salt and apply it to the body of water you're fishing and sort of look at it from an analytical fashion and go, what makes sense to me? But in my brain, that's sort of the breakdown that's rattling through my brain throughout the day. And again, you know, Jay, we were talking earlier, you fish the river, man. You know,
yeah.
A deep hole in the river, some of the stuff you're fishing is 10 feet. Well, guess where they're at when things are bad.
Right.
Yeah, easy to figure out. That's the awesome thing on shallow water. Creeks, small rivers, boys, it doesn't take much mathematic geniusness out of you to figure out where they're at. Now it might take a PhD in BS to catch him, but you know where they're at. So that would be sort of the breakdown there. John Bondi Jovi. I usually fish out of a very small boat. What is your recommendation for the net that for a net that won't take up the entire boat would be good for solo netting? What's that fold out frable, Jay?
Fold out Stowmaster.
Super light bag.
Yep.
Right? There's a thin bag that needs maintenance, And that thing folds up and takes up very little space. Okay? So I'm not going to be throwing and not have that thing unfolded and ready to go. But if I'm sort of carting around in the boat, or I got a boat partner, if I'm fishing solo, it's unfolded. If I've got a boat partner that can help me net a fish, keep it folded up, and it's going to take up far less room. Right? Now, if you've seen the clip of me and Tim on Eagle Lake, and he has his personal best blow out the net, guess what net it was, Jay?
That was a old Frable, you said, wasn't it?
It was the Stowmaster.
With a Frable bag?
Yep. Gotcha. With the standard bag. Now, what I'm telling you, nothing is perfect. Big nets have big, heavy bags that last forever. Foldable nets have thin bags so they can fold over, and the bags don't last forever. So there's a caveat, right? There's always a caveat with everything. So if you're going to use this folding net, you need to be highly paying attention to the quality and the care of that net itself, the bag of the net, right? They can dry rot. They are very thin. They can have issues where they can get blown out and things of that nature. So there's no perfect option for a collapsible net with a heavy duty bag because it doesn't make sense. The net can't, if you have the conservation net or the heavily like tarred or whatever net that's like on a clamp, it can't collapse and lay on top of itself because the actual rope, the webbing of it's too thick, right?
Yeah.
So if you're going to use this smaller bag net, you need to be diligent about, okay, I'm making sure I'm checking for holes. I'm making sure that this thing has the tensile strength that I need, and be willing to spend the money to replace that bag as needed. Right? That'd be it. Jay, is there any other option? I'm missing something, or what do you think?
No, those are good nets to good nets to look at. You know, the main thing is sunlight does more damage on light bags than anything. It wears it out, it dries it out. You know, it's just like that rubber coating on there. It just seems to deteriorate quickly if that thing's stored, especially if it's stored in the sun. You know, some people, you know,
leave them in the boat all year.
Yeah, they leave them in the boat, and the thing gets hit when you're even when you're not fishing. So, yeah, that's something to consider. So, like you said, you know, the only thing you can do, you know, if you're running the perfect bag and it's light and it fishes solo great, that's fantastic. Whatever works for you, but just keep an eye on it. It's like checking your leaders. You know, it's just one of those things you should examine before you go out.
With anything that we consider quote unquote light and musky fishing, when you hear the term light and musky, right? It's not that it's bad. It demands maintenance. Just that's the best way you can look at a light action musky rod. Guess what? You better be checking the tip. You better be checking for cracks and frays, right? A light musky line, a light musky bag. If it is light and musky, what they're telling you is it is up to you to maintain this thing to make sure it's working 100%. Right? There's nothing wrong with it. I've ran bags like that were that light, but guess what I did every couple of days? Check the whole thing. Before every time I went out, check the whole thing, right? Bring it inside so it's not sitting out there getting wet rot or dry rot or any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Where I've got a Frable conservation and a clam that I leave outside, they get snowed on, they get rained on, they get forgotten, they get abused, they get used. So there's a trade-off there. You just need to pay attention. Not that it's good, not that it's bad. The term light and the term musky in combination means maintenance is on you. Chris, hey guys, first want to thank you for all you do, providing such valuable information, tips, tricks, depth master classes, all this stuff. I especially love listening to the structure fishing ones. Well, thank you very much. They've helped me a tremendous amount. My question is, what's your guys' take on hooks when applied to common lures like bucktails, crankbaits, gliders, diving rods? Short sink versus regular, round bed versus Oshogany. Thanks a bunch. Keep the great work. Okay, so hooks and musky baits are a means to accomplish different things. Okay. So a short shank hook, all it does is shorten the shank of the hook, right? Well, what does that mean? It takes the points of the hook and gets them closer to the body of the bait. Sounds simple. Maybe some people are like, okay, why do you say that? And some people go, oh, I see what you're saying. So the actual central part of the hook has been shortened. You do not gain any width. You do not gain any gap. You don't gain a bigger diameter. It is tighter to the bait. Why would that matter? Right? Why would that matter? Well, it's about hook set. So let's say I'm throwing a 5-inch baby shallow rater, right? And I've got this small bait in a big old mouth, and I've got an instant to set the hook. I want that thing to dig in as close as possible to where that bait is. Why it works, I can't tell you the physics of it, but I like a shorter shank on smaller baits. Okay? For whatever that's worth.
Okay.
So, it's like, you got to realize when they grab the bait, in general, unless they woof it, Jay, they're actually touching the body of the bait, right? So, by reducing the length of the shank of the hook, I have faster hook penetration. So, 5-inch shallow rater. They have it in the tip of their mouth, in the corner of their mouth, right? Whatever, they've hit it. I have to move that bait a shorter distance before the points of that hook find musky face. Now, it's only, whatever, half an inch, quarter inch, whatever the difference in shank is. But it seems to help, right? On a bucktail, in my mind, the length of the hook shank matters not, because the length of the overall bait can be adjusted by the actual shaft of the bucktail. Right? Rule of thumb for me with a bucktail, I want the bottom of my hook. Like if you set a bucktail on a table and hold it up, I want the bottom of the hook even with the bottom of the skirt. Right? Maybe a hair past it for short strikes, but I want it sort of even. Doesn't matter to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the things that become interesting to me about hooks and hooks that are worth changing up become wider gap, bigger aught hooks of the same weight that don't foul. So we're just talking about and I filmed the toad video, guys. I'm sorry. This is the ongoing joke about the toad. Okay. But I actually was talking about this 7-aught wide gap short shank hooks that I put on my toads, right? So here's this way larger hook that weighs just a hair more than the standard hooks, but increases the radius of my hooking area immensely. So rubber baits, bigger is better, in my opinion, right? Bigger is better. You look at, goodness, Jay, the original, I don't know if do pounders have 8-aughts on them now? Yes.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Okay, I'm looking at the original. I've got an old school pounder and a new pounder. Those are 8s, you know. So you got this big old bait, you better have a big old hook, right? So the larger the diameter, the bigger the bite of the bait itself, the bigger the hook needs to be. Now, one thing you get into, in my opinion, is glide baits. There's a lot of glide baits that come with 3s and 4s, right?
Yeah.
They can stand some short shank, bigger hooks. The other thing with hooks you can do is some baits simply hook foul, right? Back to gliders. Man, I don't know if they still do it, but a lot of my original manas back in the day, they loved to hook foul each other, right? Or warlocks or some of these glide baits, hellhounds. Some of these baits, they will find each other's hooks, and now you've got two hooks that are connected to each other that are completely useless, right?
Yeah.
So I'll change
the hooks. We've all been there. Yeah.
The other thought process with hooks is going to be, how can I use a hook to augment how this bait runs? So let's take a baby depth rater, for instance. If we increase the hook size of the front hook, just the front hook, we got a standard baby depth rater. We increase the hook size of just the front hook. Guess what's going to happen, Jay? It's going to raise tail up. If we increase the hook size of only the back hook, it's going to raise head up, right? If we increase the middle hook, now it will raise flatly. Okay. So just by adding a bigger hook on one of those positions, say we do, I don't know what the standard hook size, what is it, a 2-aught or a 3-aught on those, Jay, off the rip, off your head?
Little baby. Yeah, 1-aught or 2-aught.
Let's call it a 2-aught. Maybe I'm wrong. It doesn't matter, but let's just call it a 2-aught for argument's sake. So if it comes with single strength 1-aughts, and I go with a 3x, excuse me, I said single strength 1-aught. Let's call it, we said call it 2. So let's say single strength 2-aughts across the factory. And I go with a 3x strong 2-aught on the front, middle, or back by itself, it will change things. It will change how that bait rises on the poles, right? Then again, with your crankbaits, if you go heavier than that or bigger hooks, guess what? It might not rise at all. So you're adding weight in incremental grams, because I'll tell you, when you're building baits, like the Titan or the Mini Titan, the Junior Titan, whatever you want to call it, it's a matter of grams, right? So small details make a huge difference with crankbaits as far as running depth. Now, the thing is this, glide baits as well. Now, glide baits, if you're going to change the hooks on the glide baits, guess what you do? You put the same hooks on it. Glide baits are weighted in a very particular way where they're pretty balanced. So don't change one hook on a glide bait. Change both for the same hook, right? And you can increase your running depth. They're going to run deeper. They're going to fall faster. It might tighten the wobble on the far, whatever you might find. But nonetheless, you're going to find that it's going to be helpful. But, you know, be judicious. Don't change hooks willy-nilly. I've done that in the past where you go, this needs bigger hooks, and you go, man, it killed the action. Be smart about it. But if you think about what the change of a hook will do, does it increase my hooking percentage or not because it overcomes the width of the bait? Does it prevent hook fouling or does it cause hook fouling? You need to consider that, right? And does it change how the bait rises at rest? Okay? Not too many bait fish, when they die, when they're going down, do they fall head down at first? A lot of bait fish will fall head up. They're trying to struggle to the surface, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Little things like that, little minutia where you go, what's better? Did it matter? Who knows, but it makes you feel better. Jay, I know you lost a lot of money on that ice fishing tournament. I'm very sorry about that. I got a big morning in the morning here. We were remiss to talk about it. There's the big sale at the Muskie Shop. It's going on till what, Tuesday or midnight Monday?
All day Monday. Yeah, 15% off. So it's a huge deal.
Can't
big
miss sale. It. Don't miss it, folks. Also, too, Junior Titans, all that stuff. Freaking folks, you know, Jay is the guy. If you need a autograph from Dick or Fritz, Jay is your man.
I'll hook you up.
All right, yep, guys. Yep. All right, Jay Bird, say good night.
Night, guys. Thank you.
Later.